Good afternoon, everybody. We shall start immediately. And first of all, let's introduce the speakers of this afternoon. Professors Michael Green and Joseph F. Sanders are both members of the American Law Institute, and they teach respectively at Wake Forest University in North Carolina and at the University of Houston in Texas. Both are distinguished tort lawyers. Professor Green being very well known among us here in the Institute because he's currently the American member of the European Group on Tort Law. And Professor Sanders is also a leading expert in sociology and theory of scientific proof and renowned author on mass torts. They are going to talk to us this afternoon about admissibility versus sufficiency, controlling the quality of expert witness testimony in the United States. You've got the floor.
Thank you. I'll spend more time getting it ready. Playing games with you. Welcome. I'm going to talk for the first few minutes. Mike said that I should talk for 5 minutes and he'll talk for 40, but we'll maybe do it a little differently. Go through the paper about to the point of discussing Daubert, and then Mike's going to pick up and talk about the rest of the paper. Here's sort of an overview up on the screen of what we're going to do. And let me just say, really the second part on the slide, is that now almost 20 years on from the decision in Daubert, we believe, and I think many people would agree with this, that it's simply not altogether clear how judges are supposed to perform this admissibility act at the beginning of American trials. It's unclear at many different levels. We're going to devote almost all of our discussion simply to federal cases in the United States where there is a problem, but the problem is in some extent beyond our paper, much more serious within the various states, each of which have special different rules about admissibility. I know Susan this morning was talking about Florida, which in my opinion has some of the most appalling admissibility rules in America, and really quite different. So it would really be very helpful, at least to judges and lawyers, we believe, if we could come to a more coherent view about what judges should do. And at least it's our view that one way to think about a more coherent view is to recognize the substantial similarities between admissibility decisions and sufficiency decisions, and to argue that many, if not most, American admissibility decisions are well thought of as sufficiency decisions. And so the paper is an attempt to try to explore that general issue of what that might look like and how we might do it. This came up earlier today too, and I wanted to talk about it a bit. Why is this an issue in the United States, and whether it's an issue anyplace else? I must confess I'm a little worried as an American professor to come here and talk about American law, but it is an intriguing way to talk about issues that we hope are more general questions about how we should make decisions in complicated causal situations. So why is there a special rule in the United States concerning the admissibility of expert testimony? And we argue really two reasons that are not separate reasons, but they go together hand in glove. The first is adversarial processes. American cases are decided very much in an adversarial system where the parties present their case. And I think I need to expand just a little bit on what that means and why we think that's important. First of all, it means that not only do the parties control the litigation, in the United States, the parties control the experts as well, unlike a number of jurisdictions where the court would appoint experts. In the United States, the parties are entirely in control of the experts. And in some jurisdictions, even where the parties can present experts, it's often the case, at least in complicated litigation, where the court might also appoint experts. That can happen in the United States, but it happens with great rarity. Only in the most severe cases, most expensive cases, are judges usually willing to hire lawyers that are not hired by the parties, and thus all we have is party experts. And as you might well imagine, those party experts have a point of view. And indeed, the very way in which party experts are chosen in America guarantees that they have a point of view. If you were a plaintiff's lawyer that had a weak case and were looking for an expert, You could talk to 100 experts. The first 99 could tell you that you're crazy. Your conversation with all those 99 would be protected by a lawyer-client privilege so that no one would ever know that you talked to 99, and you finally find person 100 who's willing to testify on your behalf, and now you're down the road towards expertise. So that's the first part of the problem. The second part, of course, is the existence of a civil jury. Juries are obviously of various qualities. Many attempts have been made in the United States to create blue ribbon juries or science juries or other kinds of specialized juries to hear particularly complex cases. None of those have gone anywhere for any number of reasons, including constitutional reasons. And so we're left with lay juries, sometimes might be quite good and sometimes might be quite bad. And that leaves this problem, this residual problem, which is that, the lawyers in, the judges in the United States are concerned that there will be a lack of quality control of expert testimony, that the experts really won't be as good as they might be. And you can see one way, there are many ways to do this, one way to try to control this is to eliminate the worst experts, or at least to put it a different way, to eliminate the experts with the weakest testimony in some way. And that basically is what's going on in these cases. I have down here at the bottom of the quality control, and if people want to later, I'd love to have a discussion about this idea of epistemic paternalism and the degree to which what we're really trying to do is make the following claim, which is that jurors will make better decisions if they don't have every piece of evidence than if they do have every piece of evidence, i.e., if they don't hear the very worst evidence, they'll come to a better decision than if they do hear all the evidence. That's a controversial kind of claim, and I don't mean to defend it here, but it does seem that it may underlie part of the judicial reasoning of why we ought to exclude certain expertise. Tell me when I've used up 20 minutes because my stopwatch broke down. Here's a bit of a discussion before the Daubert case was ever decided, for sort of leading up to what happened at that point. Before Daubert was decided, most America's jurisdictions followed a rule called Fry versus the United States, and it was used almost exclusively in criminal law cases. And it was a rule that went the following. Testimony is admissible only when it's reached general acceptance in the relevant community. So it became known as a general acceptance test. The idea was that we should look to the community of scholars that study in this area and see whether they think this was a reliable technique, a reliable method, and if it was, in fact, we should allow the testimony. If it's not, we should exclude it. In fact, Frye itself was based upon a precursor to lie detector tests, a blood pressure test. The defendant tried to introduce this evidence by way of an acquittal. I've taken this test and it proves that I wasn't lying and therefore I should be acquitted. The court said that this test had not reached general acceptance and would not allow the lie detector test in. That was the only test that we had in the United States for really since the 1920s on. And in fact, it was really never used in civil cases. Rarely used. I think Susan actually persuaded me finally that maybe there are three American cases, civil cases, that ever actually were premised on Frye, Daubert being one of them down below. So it was really quite rare, but it was used with some degree of frequency in criminal cases. So now really our story starts, which is in the 1980s, after the adoption of the federal rules, is when I think we believed courts became more and more skeptical of jury decisions and more skeptical of the quality of expert testimony, and began then for the first time to become serious about the application of some sort of a reliability filter on expert testimony. And we have a whole group of cases prior to Daubert that tried to decide that. As you can see here, they were based upon Federal Rule of Evidence 702 and 703. I think I have the next slide may be the can't remember now what the, yeah, there's the text of those rules. We'll talk about them in a minute. and finally had a number of decisions that began to exclude expert testimony based upon the existence of these liability rules. I mean, excuse me, these admissibility rules. Should say a word about the fact that a number of the cases that were involved in this period of time were in fact cases involving this drug we heard about earlier this morning, Vindectin, the drug that in fact was involved in the Daubert decision. And a great number of the cases were about that drug. But there were also a number of other cases, one of the most well-known of which was in the previous slide, Judge Weinstein's opinion in the Agent Orange litigation. That was litigation involving servicemen and others who claimed they'd been injured by a substance called Agent Orange that was widely used in Vietnam as a defoliant. The idea was it would kill the vegetation in the jungle canopy and therefore make it easier to bomb North Vietnamese because you could see what they were doing, but of course somebody had to go spray that onto the foliage and the claim was it caused injury. So there was litigation surrounding that. So the cases were involved in these two rules, and I'm not going to read them to you. I'm sure most of you who wanted to have already read them. But let me say with respect to them the following. In the many cases before Daubert, courts used both of these rules quite frequently in an attempt to decide whether to admit expert testimony. And I think it'd be fair to say they use 703 almost more than they use 702 as a basis of trying to decide whether testimony should be excluded. And in just a minute, I'll kind of show you examples of that. But as you can see, if you just look at the text of 703, it really is more about sufficiency than perhaps Rule 702 is. It basically says if the facts and data sort of aren't sufficient to support your claim, that may be a reason for excluding a body of evidence. And so 703 was pushing the courts towards a sort of a sufficiency analysis about how much evidence was necessary to in fact exclude or not exclude evidence. But as you can see, the 702 language basically says nothing about that. It's sort of completely gone. So here's a couple of examples. Using 703, as we talk about in the paper, Judge Weinstein in the Agent Orange case that I mentioned before actually talks sufficiency language, if you will, in deciding to exclude the expert testimony in the Agent Orange case. Listen to him. If the underlying data are so lacking in probative force and reliability that no reasonable expert could base an opinion on them, if they simply are insufficient to support the statement the expert wants to make, then the opinion which rests entirely upon them must be excluded. Clearly a sufficiency point of view vis-a-vis this testimony. Then we have another case in the paper that is worth mentioning. The Richardson case, another Vindectin case. In fact, both of these are Vindectin cases, both Richardson and Turpin. Here the trial judge admitted expert testimony, but entered judgment after admitting the testimony. Entered judgment as a matter of law in the Richardson case, saying, well, the evidence is simply insufficient to support a verdict, and never allowed the case to go to trial, even though he didn't really get into the exclusion of expert evidence. As you can see down at the very bottom of this opinion, made an admissibility decision not altogether unlike Judge Weinstein, built once again around Rule 703, this time with a subtle difference, basically saying the evidence that the experts chose to rely upon in the Richardson case is all well and good, but it simply can't withstand a challenge to its admissibility given the quality of the evidence presented on the other side. And so the argument basically was, well, there's some evidence here, but in this case, the evidence on the other side is so overwhelming, if you think about it for a second, then the body of all this evidence is insufficient to support a conclusion. Two other cases, and then one a little bit about Daubert. The two issues we just talked about, the ones from Agent Orange and then the one from Richardson, are reflected in everyday sort of cases that are worth mentioning because this issue is not entirely relegated to the realm of toxic torts or mass torts. This issue about sufficiency of the evidence, I guess we want to argue, occurs in many contexts, and we just want to extend it to other situations. So just a word about these two cases to kind of see how they are very similar to the outcome in both Richardson and in the Agent Orange litigation. First, Gordon, the Gordon case. It's Gordon versus the Museum of Natural Science. It's a slip and fall case. In fact, both of these are slip and fall cases, the quintessential American tort. You go to the grocery store, you slip on the banana peel, you fall down, and you sue the grocery store for your damages. There's no better case in the world, and there's no simpler case in the world. And so this first one is a slip and fall, slipped on a slippery piece of paper on the floor in the museum. And the claim is that, as you might expect in American tort law, the museum was negligent for failing to get this piece of paper off the floor in the proper amount of time. And the defendant said, well, who knows how long that paper was there? You have to produce some evidence, because after all, this piece of paper might have been there for 2 minutes. And if it was only there for 2 minutes, then there simply is no negligence in failure to remove the paper in that very short period of time. On the other hand, had it been there for 2 days or 2 hours, perhaps there was negligence. But the claim is simply a sufficiency of the evidence. If all you had was a piece of paper that you slipped on the floor, then there simply wasn't adequate evidence to support a case going to the jury, and it ought to, in fact, be excluded. And that really feels very much like the way that Judge Weinstein was prepared to talk about Agent Orange. Now, the second case here, just very quickly, is the O'Connor case, which is in the opposite, more like Richardson. Here's the situation. The individual slips on some ice at the Pennsylvania Railroad station. The defendant is the Pennsylvania Railroad. Long gone, I'm afraid to say. Swallowed up.
Poor judgment.
Yeah, right, because of that. Swallowed up. In fact, I would think it was damaged originally in Paul's graph, right? The claim, once again, was a slip and fall case. This time, the claim was, I slipped on some ice that the railroad had failed to get off of the off the sidewalk, let's say, in proper time. This time, however, there was more evidence than simply I slipped on some ice. Otherwise, it would simply be the paper claim all over again. But here it was, I slipped on some ice, and the ice was gray. Now, the implication of it being gray is it was dirty ice that had been there for some period of time, and therefore slipping on it means that they should have had it cleaned up. The defense testimony, interestingly, was expert testimony that said, oh, well, we have good data about how high the temperature had risen between the last snow and the current snow, and that between the temperature between the last snow and the current snow, it was physically impossible for any ice to remain from the first snow all the way to the second snow. So you see how that's sort of like the Richardson case. Well, there is some evidence, i.e., in the Richardson case, some animal research, what have you, pointing in the direction of liability. It is overwhelmed by the scientific evidence on the other side that basically says it can't be that the animal studies mean anything, because we know the snow is melted. We know the epidemiology points in a different direction. So in both of these ways, these are two different ways that sufficiency arguments typically could be understood to really be parallel to sufficiency arguments in ordinary tort litigation, and we think would be wise for lots of cases to go that way. And for that to be the general way that American courts think about these problems. Let me just jump ahead. I want to conclude I'll just say a word about this. I think we agree that the Daubert court unfortunately made a bad choice when it based its decision entirely on Rule 702, almost exclusively, and left maybe a sentence or two about 703. Had it based its decision like Judge Weinstein did on 703 to begin with, we probably wouldn't be here talking about this today. Probably we would have already had a sufficiency regime in place. Instead, it based it all its effort on 702. And let me just conclude my part by saying a few words about the Daubert decision. And I promise to say very little. The court granted certiorari entirely for the purposes of killing off the Frye rule. It I don't think it would have granted cert. There were 15 Bendectin cases roaming around at the time. It granted cert in none of them. It only granted cert in Daubert, and that's because down below, the Ninth Circuit had based its opinion entirely on this Frye general acceptance test. And then it developed these four factors that it said you should look at to decide whether or not evidence is admissible. The first factor that I'm sure Susan would love, because it's basically Popperian at heart, is falsifiability, and the idea that whether something has been falsified or not should be the main criteria. It had three other criteria. One, error rate, how big an error rate existed with respect to something. A typical example in the forensic area is we have a bite mark, and the expert is prepared to say this bite mark was caused by the defendant because this bite mark looks like the defendant's teeth. And the question would be, well, what's the error rate? How accurate can you be with respect to such bites? Now, the answer is almost zero, but that's the idea of error rates. And then two other tests that sort of hearkened to Frye. One, the Frye test, general acceptance, and the other, this idea of peer review and publication, the idea that, in fact, we should decide whether something had been admitted if, in fact, the results had undergone peer review in an academic climate and been published. And so those four criteria became centerpieces, and with those centerpieces, the idea of sufficiency and the idea of admissibility went down two separate tracks. And so we're trying to bring the tracks back together, and the return of the tracks sort of starts with Professor Green.
Thanks, Joe. Well, one of the things that we do in this paper is to try and explain why the Daubert factors are really not very helpful for trying to figure out whether the case should go forward or not. And we relate a case, it's a criminal case actually, that Susan was kind enough to make us aware of. And I won't go into the details, but it's humorous about how badly the court did with the falsification idea. Well, the defendant was challenging FBI forensic evidence. And the court said, well, this satisfies the testability because you've tested it. You've been able to test it. And the defendant claimed and showed that it's wrong, but the court said, no, that counts in favor of admitting this expert testimony. We think that really the four factors from Daubert sort of take your eye off the ball, and that in fact, much of what's gone on in the 20 years now since Daubert came down the factors have been used as make weights or excuses rather than analytical devices for what courts are doing. And I guess the first bit of evidence that we muster is to go back to something we talked about this morning. And that was the Daubert case when it went back to the Ninth Circuit. And the Ninth Circuit ruling that the plaintiff's major witness, Roger Palmer, could not testify and therefore entering judgment for the plaintiffs. Actually, we're inclined to think that the reason for the Court of Appeals doing that was not expressed in its opinion. But by 1993, American courts had decided that Bendectin didn't cause birth defects, full stop. That's the end. But they had to couch it in legal terms. That would not have sufficed for an opinion. We talked about specific causation, that is, whether the agent caused the individual plaintiff's disease. And Susan talked about the implication of a relative risk of two. And to try and illustrate that, yeah, there's the logic of requiring a relative risk of two, that an epidemiology study, if the group that's exposed has a greater incidence of disease than the unexposed group, then we think that, and of course the standard of proof in the United States is a preponderance, unlike for most of you Europeans. It just requires that the jury, the fact finder, find more likely than not that the element is satisfied. So a relative risk of greater than 2 means that out of the group, more than half develop their disease due to exposure to the agent, and then that would be sufficient to satisfy specific causation. What the court said was none of the studies that the plaintiff's expert was relying on, although they found some increased relative risks, none of them found a relative risk greater than 2, and therefore the plaintiffs could not win the case because they could not establish specific causation, and therefore the plaintiff's expert could not testify. Now, if we think about it, that evidence of an increased relative risk is relevant to the matter of specific causation, but it is not sufficient to carry the day for the plaintiffs. We think that Daubert remand is as good an instance of courts doing sufficiency to decide the admissibility of an expert's witness as any that exists. A parenthetical aside, Susan made a pretty standard critique of requiring a relative risk of 2.0. The plaintiff may have been more susceptible, may have been exposed to a higher dose, or we can rule out other types of causes. In this unexposed incidence, we may know of other causes, and we can say she didn't have exposure to the other known causes. Those are all justifications for not requiring 2.0. One of the two of us, and you'll have to guess which one, thinks that relative risks of 2.0 ought not to be sufficient, but not on specific causation grounds, on general causation grounds. That is, we think that a relative risk that's less than 2 is most likely noise and doesn't reveal much of anything that's useful. And the slide that we have here that attempts to demonstrate that is there were a series of epidemiology studies of systemic disease among women who got silicone gel breast implants. And this is the results, the relative risk from those numerous studies plotted around the axis of 1.0. 1.0 means no association, zero. It's no more frequent in women who had silicone gel breast implants than those who didn't. And what you see here is a scatter point of relative risks around 1.0 with maybe 40% of them being somewhat higher than 1.0 and the rest being less than 1.0. I don't think silicone gel breast implants are protective of systemic disease, which is what a relative risk less than 1 would mean. I don't think the ones that you see greater than 1.0 are any indication of general causation. This is noise. This is the problem of observational studies, which is what the epidemiology is that we're talking about, and the errors that occur in that due to the fact that they are not controlled studies, and or this could to some extent be a result of randomness to the studies. So one of us, me, is skeptical about relative risk less than 2, but not for the reasons that courts have identified in the United States, which has to do with specific causation showing that in individuals was more likely than not. The next, to get back to the point, my wife says I only have 2 problems when I talk. One is I get off the point. She says, and then Mike, unfortunately, you get back to the point. So I'll get back to the point here and talk about the next 2 Supreme Court cases, and primarily the Joyner case, which was adverted to this morning as well. Joyner involved chemicals that were used in transformers that were alleged to cause cancer. And the trial court ruled the expert's testimony was inadmissible under Daubert, but the appellate court reversed. In the course of suggesting that the methodology and conclusions, which were separate in Daubert, really aren't that separate, Chief Justice Rehnquist, who became a convert to expert witness screening, explained the connection between the scientific record and an expert's opinion. Whoa. Trained experts commonly extrapolate from existing data, but nothing in either Daubert or the federal rules requires a district court to admit evidence that is connected to existing data only by the ipse dixit of the expert. A court may conclude that there is simply too great an analytical gap, and the ipse dixit language and the analytical gap language got into the Daubert lexicon as lower courts continue to decide these admissibility cases. Courts that adopt this approach are asking the plaintiff's experts to lay out the scientific bases for their opinion. This is going back to what Joe was talking about with 703. And at the end of the expert admissibility day, the question is, what scientific evidence has been proffered in support and against the idea of factual causation? The later stages of the silicone gel breast implant litigation reveals this move away from Daubert and its factors. By this point in the silicone gel breast implant, the body of evidence had become pretty strong. It was quite weak, quite thin at the beginning, which is why that litigation flourished. But as with Bendectin, the litigation drove the science, and more studies were done and that came out and that became exonerative of silicone gel breast implants and systemic disease. In a case in the Tenth Circuit, the plaintiff sued the manufacturer of her breast implants. District Court granted summary judgment and the plaintiff appealed. The Court of Appeals and the focus of its opinion is on the scientific evidence supporting the existence of general causation. One has to read deep into the case to find any mention of Daubert or admissibility of expert testimony. The court is discussing what the scientific record is on breast implants and systemic disease. And the court explained, just as in Bendectin, the large body of epidemiologic evidence that tended to exonerate silicone gel breast implants as being the disease. This was another instance of the O'Connor case that Joe was talking about, where the evidence contrary to the plaintiff's case is so strong that judges rule that a jury couldn't find otherwise than the direction that substantial body of evidence that disputes the plaintiff's claim exists. And to us, Norris is transparently a case deciding on sufficiency grounds, not admissibility grounds, although finally the court does get to Daubert and decide on the basis of Daubert. Bendectin and silicone gel cases are of the O'Connor variety, but much more common are tort cases, toxic tort cases, where the evidence is quite thin, where we don't have a substantial body of epidemiology. And so what goes on in those cases? Well, I'll spare you discussion of all the cases that we discuss in the paper that range from brain cancer, from chemical exposure to benzene, and the claim that it causes just about any kind of cancer. To thimerosal, we've had this scandal in the United States about mercury being used in childhood vaccines and the belief by the parents of many children who develop autism, that it is the mercury component in the preservative that's causing this rash of autism. To even a durable good, a four-wheel drive automobile that lost traction, and the claim in that case that it was due to a defect in the car, and finally to postpartum strokes in women allegedly as a result of a drug that suppressed lactation. The one that I will I won't do that. Let me fast forward and get to the Parlidel litigation because it's so interesting. Parlidel was the anti-lactation drug that was given to postpartum women who decided not to breastfeed their children. It was taken off the market because of concerns about its adverse effects. And after it was taken off the market, there was a rash of litigation by women who had suffered strokes after taking Parlidel. Well, there was an attempt to look at this epidemiologically, and Ken Rothman, the prominent epidemiologist who used to be associated with Harvard, attempted to do a study to figure out whether there was an association, and then to reason, using Sir Bradford Hill, whether that association, if existed, was causal. And what Rothman found is that the incidence of stroke in women postpartum is so infrequent, and that he could only find 10 cases of postpartum women who had strokes. Well, even using the methodology that's best for investigating when you've got a very rare disease, they found a modestly elevated relative risk, but the numbers were so small that Rothman was unwilling to make any judgments about causation there. There just wasn't sufficient number of cases to be able to test this. There was some other evidence, including mechanism evidence, about Parlidel being a vasoconstrictor and therefore maybe resulting in constriction in the cerebral cortex that would then be the basis for a stroke. There was a little bit of chemical structure that was similar, but it was bits and pieces. Well, not surprisingly, courts came to different conclusions. Some said the plaintiff's expert can testify in this case, and some said they can't. And we had a lot of hand-wringing in the United States about these inconsistent determinations. Let me see if I can get, I don't want to do that. Yeah, there's the hand-wringing of Parlidel. And this is a quote from a prominent, I think he's a philosopher and also a lawyer, Carl Craner in the United States, about this inconsistent determinations. We don't share that angst at all. Well, a little bit, but not nearly what most observers were concerned about with these inconsistent determinations. We don't share it because whether circumstantial evidence that is neither hopelessly weak nor quite substantial puts courts in a very difficult position of policing the line between what is a reasonable inference that a fact finder could make and what is circumstantial evidence that is too thin and therefore would require the fact finder to engage in what we term as speculation that's impermissible. Of course, that's the line for sufficiency of the evidence determinations. And if we're right that that's what's going on, we should not be surprised that courts come to conflicting decisions, as they did, to go back to the ordinary tort case. This is not, well, I guess it's kind of a slip and fall. There's a case, I think it's back in 1934, in New York courts, where the plaintiff's decedent fell down a stairway that was unlit. It was unlit due to the negligence of the defendant. The question in the case was causation. Did she fall because of the lack of lights, or did she fall because of some other cause? And in this case, in Wolf, in 1934, the appellate court in New York said, no, it would be solely conjecture for the jury to decide that it was due to the negligence of the defendant. 9 years later, another case in New York, same judge. The issue in the case was whether the plaintiff's decedent fell down a flight of stairs due to a heart attack or dizziness while carrying a 32-pound box, or whether, on the other hand, she fell on the second to last step and the injuries in the fall caused the death. Again, causation. Again, question of whether it was a defect, in this case, a defect in the steps, or another cause, namely a heart attack. And nobody knew because the plaintiff's decedent was dead. Court in that case decides that causation is a matter for the jury, that this is a reasonable inference that the jury could draw. Well, maybe we could distinguish those cases. Maybe we could distinguish the Parlidel cases. There's actually a basis for distinguishing them so that each plaintiff is not identical in terms of their risk. But the point is, appreciating the connection to sufficiency of the evidence, this is a matter that has bedeviled and split courts. Courts in which four judges think it's a question for the jury and three think that it's not. If we're right, and we may not be, but if we're right, what are the implications of, oh, this is the uncertain line between reasonable inference and impermissible speculation that Joe is particularly fond of because it comes from the third restatement of torts. If we're right, there are a couple of implications to this. Fry and its general acceptance test required judges to look to others, to look to the scientific community to try and make a judgment about the admissibility of expert testimony. While Daubert rejected Fry, some of its factors save an important role for the opinions of others. That is, general acceptance is one, and publication and peer review is another. If courts are moving to a sufficiency analysis, we should expect a reduced role, reduced importance for Fry and its factors. Whether the evidence of causation in tort context is sufficient to send to a judge, the judge has to look at what the scientific evidence is and make a judgment him or herself with the help of experts, but make a judgment about whether that scientific record is sufficient for a jury to find causation. A recognition that admissibility decisions are often sufficiency judgments presents an opportunity to rethink the decision in Joyner that the standard of review on Daubert decisions is abuse of discretion. That, of course, is the standard of review for all evidentiary determinations. But the standard of review for sufficiency determinations is simply whether the lower court erred. There's no room given to a judge deciding a sufficiency determination. Finally, if Daubert is about sufficiency, one might ask, shouldn't courts go back to what happened in Richardson that Joe laid out, where we try the case? We try it to a jury, we get all the evidence out, and then make a judgment, not trying to decide this before the case is tried, which is the current practice under Daubert. Well, one of us thought that was right, at least when Daubert was decided, and I've changed my mind. I think not, and I think not because of the experience with Daubert. What we've been able to do is front end a pretty thorough assessment of the scientific evidence brought in by the experts for the judge to consider, to give the defendant an opportunity to present its evidence contrary and to critique the plaintiff's evidence and to sort of thoroughly thrash out, without the need for a trial, what this evidence is and whether it's sufficient for a causal judgment. So we really don't see a need, and indeed there's a great deal of time saving that can be had if judges use Daubert wisely. That does not require full trials. So what we see, if we're right and we've identified what's really going on, the main thing would be greater transparency in Daubert hearings and greater coherence when judges are told, this is really what you're doing here. It's similar to what you've been doing for a long time, making sufficiency judgments. And I think that would help lawyers in their presentation of the cases and, if not change outcomes, at least make more coherent what's going on in these determinations.
Okay, thank you very much, Professor Sanders, Professor Green. And now let's start the debate, and you have the floor. So,
how do I turn this on? It's on. Okay, it's on. Oh, it's on. I have a long list, so I've cut it down to something tolerable, I hope. First, a factual question, then a friendly observation about the Daubert factors, and then the question which has perhaps some real teeth. Okay, first the simple factual question. We know a little, but not a lot, I think, about how good juries are or aren't at assessing complicated expert testimony. Not a lot, but something. I'm curious, what do we know about judges' competence to do this, which I suspect varies just as much as juries does? That's the factual question. Apropos of the Daubert factors, I agree with you that they haven't proven terribly helpful. I think it might be one way to bring this out, which you didn't take, would be to point out that, in a sense, since Joiner, the Supreme Court has done something that looks remarkably like dismantling them. Because, first of all, in Joiner, it gives up the distinction between methodology and conclusions. And then in Kumho, in effect, it says, well, Daubert applies to all expert testimony, but the factors aren't necessarily appropriate, so you may use all of them, or some of them, or none of them, or whatever other factors seem to you appropriate. And by this point, they've effectively wiped the slate clean and advised judges to use their heads. So I think if I were making the argument that they're not very helpful, I would add the Supreme Court seems in some sense to have recognized this by backing away from them. Okay. Now here comes the question with teeth. If I understand you correctly, you have really two theses, one of which is descriptive and one of which is normative, to speak in a philosophical kind of way. The descriptive one is that this has been a common pattern among courts as a way of using Daubert. I dare say you're right, but I also know that there are instances where courts have very strongly resisted this way of using Daubert. I didn't come prepared with a list, but I'm remembering, for example, Justice Reber's dissent in George, which is a recent Vermont case, where he says, look, we cannot use this. We can't use the admissibility test as if it were a sufficiency test, because then we'd be asking the plaintiff to prove his case twice. And this is unacceptable. This is not what we're trying to do. So I would think that if you want to make your descriptive thesis stronger and richer, there ought to be a place for the counterexample cases, of which I'm guessing there are many. Okay. When it comes to the normative case, I'm going to take it you're saying this has become quite a common practice, and that's a good thing. At least I take it that's your view. It's a good thing that it has. I don't hear very strong arguments why it's a good thing. It would save time, yeah. But then a lot of shortcuts would save time, and not all of them are desirable. It would introduce more coherence, indeed. But then, if all courts used Daubert the same way, whichever it was, right, whether as a way of simply a question of admissibility or as a way of making a sufficiency decision under the table, as it were, whichever way they went, if they all went the same way, we would have coherence. So I'd like to hear more about why you think reading Daubert this way, using it this way, is better than reading it the way Justice Reber would have read it, for example.
That's a good question. The last one. It makes sense to us, or it makes sense to me, let me speak for myself, because I can understand an effort to look at the scientific record and to draw an unclear line, to be sure, an indistinct line, but to draw an indistinct line that says, you know, this evidence requires too much of the fact finder to permit the plaintiff to win here. This is something we've been doing for a long time, making sufficiency judgments. They're not perfect, and it's hard to find that line, and I want to think some more about you know, trying to locate that line, because I can't figure out one up to now. But I don't know what the admissibility decision is that the court contemplated in Daubert. And I would suggest that if in fact we have devolved into this judging the scientific, that there's something going on in law that we have reverted to this becoming a sufficiency determination, that judges can understand better than what the conception was back in 1993.
It takes me back to my first problem, which is that to make that out requires a much closer look at the rulings in the other direction. The court's
We would be grateful if you would supply us with that case. I must say, we did not, in preparing this paper, try and canvass the entire body of Daubert decisions. That would be...
Especially those wrong ones. Yeah.
That would be Herculean. And one of the things that we've talked about over the years, this is a topic that Joe and I have been talking about for, I don't know, half a dozen years or so, is to figure out a methodology. Because in the end, the descriptive part is... it's empirical. It's a claim about what's going on. And we've been very anecdotal about the evidence that we put together, and we concede that. What we've been trying to think about is how we might be more rigorous about trying to describe what's going on. And other than slogging through, I don't know, thousands of cases, we haven't yet come up with a good way to do that. But we're happy to look. Yeah. And we'd love for anybody who has a suggestion about how we might become more rigorous in what we've done.
I have a question about your question, Susan. What does it mean for a case to be a counter case? And the reason I don't mean that as a rhetorical question, I ask it because for the very brief description of the George case you gave me, it sounded as if his criticism of a Daubert decision was the idea of having two decisions, i.e. a decision on the admissibility of the experts at point one, and then potentially a jury decision about the sufficiency of the evidence at point two, and the objection resided around the idea of pulling those two things apart rather than having them all as a set piece at the end. That seems to me to be, to some extent, a different objection than an objection which would go like this. We should not retreat to sufficiency. We should base our decision entirely upon the Daubert factors. Those are two different types of critiques. Was I right to suggest that the critique you had was the former critique?
Okay.
Yes?
Okay. No, all I was thinking something much simpler than that,
okay.
Actually.
Sorry.
Last year I wrote a paper about the relative risk greater than two idea. arguing that it was a very bad test for specific causation. And in the course of writing that paper, I read a lot of courts who thought it was a great idea. It was either necessary, or it was sufficient, or it was required for admissibility. And any number of courts who thought that it was a terrible condition. And in the second part of that research, I uncovered any number of cases where, for one reason or another, courts were very self-consciously saying, we are making a decision about admissibility, not about sufficiency. And that was the class of cases, the more general class, of which George happened to be a particular subtype that I was hoping that you could at some point look at.
We should.
You should, I think.
Yeah. And I can actually understand why a court would say that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Let me just say one thing about your first question, just as an aside, because it comes up so often, about relative competence of judge versus jury. There is quite a bit of empirical evidence on that, and it points in many directions. Does all empirical evidence point in many directions? Perhaps so. But there is at least some evidence by Corvera and her associates saying that if you ask judges what falsifiability means, they don't have a clue. They're just terrible at actually giving a definition of what is going on.
The best one I ever read was, if there's white out on the document, it's being falsified.
Right. but I don't think that's a full answer. I mean, I think it, in any case, there is some evidence which is not irrelevant.
Okay, so, Carmen, please.
Okay. Given your idea of science, I mean, in footnote 37 of your paper, don't you have to accept a kind of interpretation of Fry general acceptance as the best criteria of admissibility? Do you remember the footnote 37?
You know, I have every footnote memorized except for footnote 37. I don't know how I missed that one. Look up 37. Let us take a look at it.
By the way, if 37 is wrong, Mike wrote it. Mike wrote this, definitely. I'll let him figure out.
Well, if you wanted, I could read it.
No, that's good.
Okay, it's science. Science. Well, it says something like science is less about knowledge than about an accepted process for conditionally accepting theories or explanations of natural phenomena as true.
Joe wrote it. No,
I think we probably ripped this off from Susan.
Yeah.
Would you say?
I guess what I don't understand in your question is why you think that this requires general acceptance.
Well, because some people say that the try to interpret the general acceptance like a accepted process or the accepting of theories as a true for a specific scientific community. That's why I thought that to be coherent, maybe you should to accept this standard of admissibility.
General acceptance is typically applied. I mean, one of the problems with general acceptance is general acceptance of what? What is it has to be generally accepted? And I think, for the most part, general acceptance has been applied to the theory, right? Or the test, for example. I mean, it began with lie detectors. And so with regard to lie detectors, is the reliability of lie detectors to tell us something useful about lying or truth-telling, is that generally accepted in the community? It's much less clear what we mean by general acceptance when we get to the toxic context that Joe and I are talking about. For one thing, scientists don't give a hoot about specific causation. They couldn't care less about it. Scientists are interested in general theories, not matters with regard. Specific causation is a legal concept, not a scientific concept that we in law develop because we're interested in the individual. Scientists, when they get to general causation, that's all they're interested in. And so I suppose we could think about general acceptance of general causation, right? Does the community of scientists who do this work accept that there is general causation? I suppose. Yes?
I couldn't understand if you were talking as well about reliability or just throwing out a reliability criteria. Because you were talking about the sufficiency, but not almost nothing about the reliability. So, do you think that it has a play or it is?
I guess my own view here is, and Joe may disagree with this, is when courts are trying to assess the reliability of the methodology of an expert, other than did you look at the body of scientific evidence, and did you then use your best judgment about that scientific evidence to reason to your opinion, right? That's the only methodology that makes any sense to me in this context. And that's very much of really what we're talking about with regard to sufficiency.
I think we weren't clear on this point, and so I think you're right to point it out, and we should be clear. We're not arguing that the so-called reliability filter should not be in place. We basically accepted that, and we've simply said that we think the courts ought to think about reliability in terms of sufficiency. So that's we ought to say that in a sentence, and I promise we will.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, there are a number of questions, please. Professor Stapleton.
Thanks, and this is really not my field, so I've got three probably very naive points to make. First one about, quality of judges. This is, I remember 10 years ago when I started teaching in the States, I'd go to conference after conference, and whatever happened, it didn't matter what side of the plaintiff's bar or the defense bar, didn't matter who was speaking, judges, academics, whoever, no one said anything about the jury. And yet all the doctrines were set up to keep things away from the jury. And I didn't really understand this. And so what I was intrigued about was why people wouldn't criticize the jury. And I eventually, after a couple of years, the penny dropped. It wasn't that people didn't think there were problems with the jury, it's just they thought trial judge was so much worse, so it would be better giving issues to the jury than to leave them in the hands of the trial judges, because the quality was so, let's say, variable. But it's interesting that, of course, Daubert, and the screening of expert evidence, hands it to this problematic class of very variable quality people. And it's just an observation. Second point I want to make is the point that Susan made about you don't really have much meat yet on your normative argument about this being a good thing. And excuse me if this is really crude, but it does echo with what you've done in the third restatement about pushing courts to repackage what they're at the moment saying as no duty holdings as no breach as a matter of law holdings. And it seems to me that what you're really saying here is, look, why don't we just admit these are no sufficiency as a matter of law holdings? And so, which makes me then think, what happened before? Was that not a common thing for trial judges to do? I don't understand the procedure, but maybe there wasn't a capacity for them to say, look, I've read the stuff, and it seems to me that no reasonable jury could possibly find this sufficient to hold Thatcher causation. So that's just a question. And I guess my last point, which is my baby, is that you don't mention asbestos and all these beautiful, elegant worries the Supreme Court has about evidence and experts, nothing about asbestos, nothing about these experts who are allowing mesothelioma claims, and we don't know how that cancer is caused, and you're still having people being held jointly and severally liable for merely exposing someone to an agent with no methodology, let alone theory of how meso is caused.
So, Jane, with regard to your second question, what happened before Daubert? As Joe said, nothing happened before Daubert. Nothing happened before Daubert, well, before Agent Orange, which is late 70s, and Bendectin. Because, first of all, prior to the federal rules of evidence, it was much more difficult to get expert testimony admitted. The federal rules liberalized, as the court said in Daubert, the ability to have experts testify. And at the same time, you have this growth in cases that require expert testimony, right? The modern toxics emerge really with asbestos in the late 70s is really when it begins, and Bendectin and other case congregations that really didn't emerge until that time. So it was the combination of let it in, which had always been the attitude. So long as they were qualified in civil cases, they could testify subject to the restrictions that existed, the common law restrictions, right? The federal rules opened that up, and there was, on the demand side, a great deal of demand for that. And it was very quick, right? Judge Weinstein and Agent Orange, who first grabbed on to this, and then Bendectin brought it to the Supreme Court. With regard to asbestos, our Supreme Court has nothing to say about that. This is a matter of state law, and I don't see the constitutional issue.
There are federal claims with regard to federal employees. Getting meso just as well. It's in the federal court system. These cases are you are getting employees recovering from meso in the federal court system. That it's feasible that it could have gone up to the Supreme Court. It's just a very strange contrast between the care with which these experts are being now scrutinized, and yet your biggest mass tort by far, the experts there are let through. Courts just accept the fictions that you've got in place, and it's just the elephant in the room.
Yeah. There may be some Federal Tort Claims Act cases, Jane, but even in those, although it's federal law that's borrowed from state law. And yes, the court would have the authority to do something with that, as it sometimes does in admiralty cases. That's one opportunity our court would have. I don't think they have any inclination to mess with that because they don't see that there's a big problem there.
That's my point, isn't it? That the by far the biggest mass tort you have can only be administered by your courts by resting on these extraordinary causation fictions, which are backed up by junk science, and yet none of this debate is actually impinging on this vast mass tort. I know why that's the case. It's in everyone's interest, really, to just administer it. It's a disaster, let's administer it. But let's not forget that the area in which all these ideas should have the greatest impact, it's not being applied.
Jane, these cases are a disaster, but it's not because of what the courts are done, it's because of what Congress didn't do and should have done decades ago and gotten this out of the courts. And they had a number of opportunities, and we couldn't get all of the constituents together to agree to anything. That would have been the best solution here. Not anything the Supreme Court could have done.
I wouldn't want to go on at length. Why don't you say a word about this? I've read every lousy asbestos case because of stupid. So I've read them all, state and federal, at some point. And you're absolutely right that there are special rules about asbestos. It is much easier to get your evidence admitted in asbestos cases. I've always attributed that to the fact that in the early going, it was so obvious that the defendants were such bad people that nobody cared. And so they ignored the laws of the rules of causation because they just were so certain on damages, or so certain on liability. But I would say this interesting fact, in my opinion, the most extreme asbestos case opinions never seem to leak out of the asbestos arena. Those cases and the rulings only live in this asbestos world, and they never get out into other toxic torts, which is sort of a recognition in a backhanded way that they're special rules.
Yeah. That's what I think. I think it's extreme.
Thank you. There are a number of works, and Professor Taruffo.
Just a word about general acceptance. I wonder if it is not an empty standard. What does general acceptance exactly mean? Because of at least two reasons. If I remember well, the Fry case was decided in 23 and was a case about a lie detector. All very quickly superseded by the history. So we are discussing of a standard that when was expressed had in that historical moment a meaning completely different of the meaning, the concrete meaning that the same standard would have now. Now, what surprises me is the almost complete lack of historical sensitivity while we are talking of that. Because if we apply systematically that kind of standard, well, I remember that until 1606, there was a general acceptance of a theory of the universe according to which the earth was flat and the sun was turning around. Why is not so? Well, so I am afraid that when we talk of, when the courts talk of general acceptance, they are wildly overstating the problem, or maybe they are not intended, well, under general acceptance, everything must go, can go. General or prevailing or overwhelming. There are exceptions to a theory. The history of science shows that many times the minority opinion was the correct one. And the history of science showed that the correct opinion was not the so-called generally accepted opinion. We know a lot of examples of that. So my surprise, and I shut up, is how can we keep discussing of a hollow standard that with the danger of use it in order to justify any kind of decision, because everything goes with such a vague standard of selection. Thanks.
Well, I agree with almost everything you said, so I don't know how much I can add. There's a wonderful article by Paul Gianelli back in the Columbia Law Review in 1980, I believe, before Daubert was decided, in which he reviews all of the Fry tests between 23 and 80 and comes to almost all the conclusions you just came to, including one more conclusion, which was that general acceptance with respect to which community. And so in the forensic area, we have all the handwriting experts, which allegedly constitute the community of general acceptance. And of course, all of them are talking to each other and none of them have any science to back up what they've said. And so clearly the general acceptance test, in my opinion, was a total failure in that context. But it's still used today, and so it's something we can't disregard. There are many states, as Susan said, and other states as well, New York, California, that still purport to use the Fry test as their test in America, and so we have to be serious in trying to figure out what they mean. I would say one final thing. In the mass tort arenas that we've seen in the United States, such as the silicone breast implant litigation, it is true that the science over time changed. and admissibility changed. And now those cases weren't entirely based upon general acceptance by any means, but the very earliest silicon cases, the experts actually were allowed to testify. It was only as the science developed that the court said, well, no, there's simply not sufficient evidence. And so it's still alive and well.
Let me add, I think it would be the height of hubris for lawyers and judges to decide that a scientific principle that is accepted should be rejected and that we know better than the scientists. They may be wrong, but our ability to ferret out when they're wrong, I am deeply skeptical of.
Professor Chusan?
I have a question. Your one guess of your PowerPoint presentation, if you may see it again, was about a series of studies on Benedictine.
Benedictine?
No, it was the silicon plus implant studies, I think we're talking about.
Oh, okay, yeah.
This
that one
here?
Yep, that's it, yeah.
Now, Fred Steve.
Yes.
Didn't remember exactly. There's, maybe it's just a personal curiosity. For all these tests, there was a statistical significance conclusion. There is a number about statistical significance of each one of these.
I doubt that any of, or very many of these were statistically significant, given that they don't find anything. It's very hard when you're finding effects this small to find something that's statistically significant. But I'm not sure.
It depends from a number of people that were tested, I guess.
And it also depends upon whether these were case control or cohort studies.
I think I know the answer to this, because the Institute of Medicine study, I think, picked out two or three to talk about, and those were the only ones that were statistically significant in the direction of causation. There were some that were actually purported to say, by statistical significance, that breast implants were prophylactic. They actually reduced the probability of...
The majority of them.
Yeah, and obviously they didn't talk about it. So very few were statistically significant, two or three at the most.
This is a technical question.
Yes.
Yeah, a number of things, and I'll try and be quick. One is that, as I mentioned this morning, on just a factual sort of thing, that on when you describe the Daubert case on remand on page 21, the court employed but one of the factors, the peer review and publication, to conclude that opinions based on reanalysis were inadmissible. That isn't true. They kind of said that, you know, if you would have shown a methodology of how you did the reanalyzing, we would have allowed it. You know, so you might want to correct that. And then back on footnote 37, which none of you wrote, right?
There's a third undisclosed author.
Yes.
And we're going to keep her undisclosed for her own protection.
Is this okay? Yeah. The footnote is... Hello? It's a footnote to a discussion of basically the use of scientific knowledge in terms of general causation. And I think the way the footnote proceeds, it kind of switches into specific causation, which is something that's a little bit confusing. Because when you talk about 702 and 703, you're talking about basically they're replacing the general acceptance standard for general causation, you know, scientific theory, with other sorts of ways of trying to prove this is a scientifically valid way of saying, in general, this can cause this. So on that sort of issue, when you kind of say that these processes are not invoked to answer the kinds of questions the law requires in a tort case, well, one of the questions is the general causation question, which is the big preliminary question in all these sorts of cases before you get to specific causation. So I think that the first part of the footnote has to kind of say, well, these are certainly relevant, these processes, to general causation. That's what mainly used, right? But I think also on the second part that it's, none of these processes and science in general is not useful on the issue of specific causation. I think that's wrong also, because science especially, taking away epidemiologists, what they're precisely trying to do is learn the mechanisms, learn the causal laws. And to the extent you have those causal laws specified, the more and more specified, that's the way in which you're able to prove specific causation by saying, in this case, those elements of the causal law were filled in. The mechanism actually occurred in this way. It didn't occur in that way. So I think the footnote is wrong in two ways. My third thing is just that when you say we might want to reconsider the abuse of discretion standard, which I think, you know, given your view, really should be reconsidered, because if it is a sufficiency view, if it is the ordinary sort of, should this be taken away from the jury? Underneath our system, issues of fact are for the jury and are supposed to be viewed de novo if a reasonable person could decide the other sort of way. So I think that on the abuse of discretion issue, you really should say, given your view, which I agree with, that these end up being sufficiency judgments, that indeed it was, and it's wrong underneath our constitutional provisions to say that it's not de novo review by the appellate court whether a reasonable person, which includes people on the appellate court, could decide different than the trial court did.
Yeah, setting aside the last one, which I don't really disagree with, on the general versus specific, it is difficult to judge. I was influenced at a conference I was at where Professor Dweed at Cambridge, a statistician, made the distinction between looking for the effects of causes and looking to the causes of effects, which at first blush sounds to be like a rather silly idea. But it is true that most scientists are looking for the effects of causes. And specific causation is particularly looking for the causes of effects. We start with the endpoint and are looking backward. And to some extent, I do think we get much less help from science. Not no help, but much less help from science on that latter question. And we get admissibility decisions based on what in American tort law is called differential diagnosis, which is basically clinicians shooting off their mouth about what caused what, based often on no evidence whatsoever except their experience and judgment. And so I do think that, you know, insofar as we haven't fully captured that distinction, it's important. And the reason I think it's relevant to our discussion here today, we haven't talked much about the third case in the Daubert trilogy, the Kumho Tire case, but it is at least as important as the other two. And I read that case, and I think it supports our view, which is why I'm about to say what I'm going to say. It really supports the idea of looking at causation with respect to this particular plaintiff, mm-hmm. and really drives the whole discussion towards that particular thing. And it seems to me that that discussion inevitably feels to me like a sufficiency discussion.
Right. Well, you know, and I was at the same conference, and I agree that scientists don't in general aren't trying to analyze what particularly caused it in this particular case. They're trying to figure out the causal laws. What I'm saying is that they're figuring out those causal laws is exactly what's required for us to make judgments of specific causation. You know, that's the mechanism that occurred in this case. If all we have is general statistics epidemiology, we can't do that. If instead we have the mechanism and kind of say, these steps in the mechanism occurred here to a sufficient degree to convince us, that's what happened in this case. So the scientists aren't interested in that question, but scientific knowledge is critical for us to answer that question in the law, specific causation as well as general causation.
Yeah, you know, to borrow from the old Honeywell ad about, I don't know, something, and that day is not today. Look, someday that evidence, Richard, I think is going to displace epidemiology. When we understand mechanisms, when we understand the steps by which the disease developed, then it becomes like a car crash where somebody gets out with a broken arm, right? And we don't need epidemiology when it comes to car crashes, right? Partly because we can eliminate other causes, but partly because we understand the mechanism of a broken arm, right? Well, when we understand the mechanisms that are involved in disease like we understand the mechanisms with bone fractures, the epidemiologists are going to be unemployed. Yeah. We won't need them. Don't tell them I said that, but it's true. But that day is not today.
So the final question.
No, I will waive my questions.
Okay, so we are on time, and I suggest that we go to take a coffee right now. But before, thank the speakers for.